Hey, can you hear me?
Oh yeah, here we go.
Yeah, we're in business.
All right, excellent.
Sorry about that.
No worries. No worries. Hey, glad we could figure out time so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
This works. So, hey, if you're ready, we can just get started.
Sure.
All right. Let's start with your year of graduation, including if it was spring or fall or summer, and your major.
I believe I graduated in 2010, and I think it was the spring after the spring semester. And my major was professional music, guitar principal.
Guitar principal, very cool. All right. Well, we will get to your history later, but for now, tell us about your current job. What do you do?
Well, I actually have two current jobs at the moment. I'm kind of a contractor, but like a permanent contractor at two one's a venture capital firm and one's a private equity firm.
Permanent contractor is basically where they don't give you any benefits, but usually the hourly looks pretty nice.
Yep. And it's they're not huge firms, so they don't require a full time commitment. And it was understood from the get go that was going to be. I was looking for that. It's not like I'm hoping for full time at one place and was just trying to piece together what I could. And
you said venture capital. What was the other one again?
The other one's a private equity firm. So one's a biotech venture capital firm called Metaphase Venture Partners, and it actually has another wing of it that just opened up that is called Limulus Venture Partners, which is the same thing, just kind of a different entity. And then the private equity firm what's called a secondaries fund of funds. So what it does is it does a lot of things, but it primarily buys other investors' interests in private equity firms and kind of creates a portfolio of buying the interest in these firms on a secondary basis. So what does that mean? That means like if you are an investor who, whatever private equity firm like Bain Capital came to you and said, we need $1 million. And then you invest $1 million and the private equity is investing in private companies, right? So you can't trade that money on an open market. You can't trade your interest in this private equity firm on a stock exchange. So if for whatever reason down the road, you're in it for a while and you're saying, you know, I've gotten some money out. It'd be really nice to just kind of get some more out and not have to be tied to this anymore. We would come and buy it at a discount, hopefully to what it's worth, and kind of create a portfolio, a fund of those types of investments. That's a very simplistic way of putting what they do, but that's kind of the idea.
Awesome. But do you mention the name of that private equity fund?
It's called Kendall Investments, and they actually have two parts to them. They one is the secondary fund of fund, and the other side is they invest in this side that I'm explaining now. I actually have very little involvement in, so I'm not going to do it justice, but I do know them a bit, and they it's called Kendall Sustainable Infrastructure, where they buy solar panel projects and from developers and build solar panel farms. I don't know if that's the right word for them. Sell the electricity generated from that. And it's also kind of like a fund structure, like a private equity fund structure.
Sure. Sure. Very cool. And what is your role at each of these places?
So at Metaphase, I'm kind of at both of these places, I'm kind of a jack of all trades in some financial and administrative respects. At Metaphase, I do more of like, I do some accounting and, kind of bookkeeping type stuff, along with some administrative office management operations type stuff. Mm-hmm. At Kendall, I'm, a little different over there. I kind of am a liaison between, some third parties like our fund administrator and our tax accountants, our tax preparers, the partner, the manager, and I keep kind of the reporting on schedule. I also, keep track of the investments and how they're performing. I do some valuations on some of the individual companies that they're invested in. And then I also kind of, I track the performance and every quarter we send out a kind of, what's called a portfolio review that kind of gives a little narrative for how each of the investments are doing within the funds. And, when I track the investments, I kind of, put it together in this presentation for investors that says, all the different companies that are, how they're performing in each of the funds, if that makes sense.
That's great. Now, I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but I think of metrics for analyzing growth or whatever, performance can be relatively simple. What happened to the revenue? What happened to the profits this quarter? But valuation always struck me as very complicated to assess, particularly when you're talking startups that are all flying on hope for the future. So how do you do those valuations?
Well, I'll try not to get too far into the weeds because it will put a lot of people to sleep, but it's basically, I should say that I find a lot of it interesting. I mean, you're right. There are some companies where, it's very hard to value because they don't even have much revenue. They're still kind of in the, you know, their infancy and, bringing their product to market and fundraising and everything like that. So how do you value something that is yet to perform? In that case, there's usually some kind of recent financing round that they have gone through, that can kind of give you an idea of what they're worth. So if they just, held a financing where that, at whatever series they, these startup companies have series, they have a series A and then they get to a series A1 or B or something like that and just kind of have these different events where they're raising equity and there's a price that people are willing to pay at that series where they say, okay, well, it looks like, you know, your company is worth X, so I'll pay this many dollars for X percentage of your company. And if you can get your hands on what people have been paying and what they've raised, it's kind of that's the closest you'll get to the market deciding what the price is, right? Because it's, you know, some investors who have come together and agreed that this is what they think it's worth and this is what they're willing to pay for. If it's a more mature company, there can be a variety of things that you use, or a variety of different techniques. One is a discounted cash flow model, where if they are, if they have profit and they've had profit for a couple of years and it's growing at a certain rate, you can kind of project what their profits are going to be into the future and then use a discount rate to kind of bring it back to what you think it's worth now.
Discount meaning future dollars are worth less than present dollars.
Right. And so it's, you try to get the present value of the future cash flows, right? It's just like a basic present value kind of calculation. And that one, I have to admit, I'm not crazy about because that feels like you're kind of, who knows what like a cash flow is going to be in 5 years or 10 years or whatever. There are ones where you compare, you kind of create a basic enterprise value for the companies based off of comparable companies that are trading in the public market. So if it's like a company that like a biotech company, you can find a whole bunch of biotech companies trading on the stock exchange and see at what multiples they're trading at. So if they're trading at, you know, it seems to be that the average is they're trading at, you know, 5 times revenues, then you can kind of get an idea of what a company like that might be worth based on that multiple. And then you usually almost always price it at a significant discount based on the fact that it's not a public market and it's maybe not as mature a company.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And then there are, I mean, like, valuations is a thing where you, I mean, there are whole firms dedicated to exactly that. You know, there, I mean, I've seen them all the time, especially since it's a fund to fund it. A lot of companies pay these firms to analyze what they think these companies are worth. And there's things you can get into, like the Black-Scholes model, and, you know, option pricing models, and all kinds of stuff that there's, you know, there's a whole industry dedicated to it. So it can get very complicated.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And backing up, you mentioned that at, I think it was Metaphase, you do some administrative duties.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a,
like,
sorry?
How big a company is it, and then what are you doing for them exactly?
It's not a big company, but, you know, with these, with investment firms, you can be a small company people-wise managing a whole lot of money.
Sure.
So there's many, many, many millions of dollars floating around in that place, but there's not a whole lot of personnel. And so I kind of make sure the bills get paid on time, because I'm the only one there to do it. So it's not, you know, there can be a day where I push send on a wire for a ridiculous amount of money and at the same time have to go and make sure rent got paid and the internet got paid and it all got booked right, you know.
Hey, for what it's worth, my wife works at a startup and she's a software quality engineer, and every once in a while they have stuff that needs to get packed in boxes, and it's like, okay, here you
go. There you go.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's life at a small company.
That's right.
So, hey, just curious, would you say you're a contractor? Like, are you working through an agency, or are you sort of an independent contractor?
I'm independent.
Good. So they pay you. They don't pay some other agency that takes a fraction of the money and then pay
no,
you.
No. Absolutely not. Okay. I should mention I'm a CPA, too. So it makes it a little easier to kind of find this kind of work without having to go through some kind of agency.
Gotcha. Hey, so would you mind, you mentioned a bunch of stuff, but would you mind like zooming in now and to take us through your typical day at Take Your Pick of the Company?
Sure. There isn't much of a, there's not a lot of typical days. At Metaphase, I work remotely for part of the time. So there's times that I'm in the office and there's times that I'm at home. And so it's nice to have that kind of flexibility too. And I would say a typical day, depends on where you are in the reporting cycle, right? So a lot of my job is making sure we're ready to get out financial statements on a quarterly basis. And if you're reaching the end of the quarter, there's going to be a whole lot of activity happening where We're putting together statements for investors to, you know, say what their position is roughly worth at that point in time, and then we send them a whole set of financial statements. So when it gets to that time, there's a lot of back and forth between me and the CFO, making sure the books are closed, reviewing the financial statements, and kind of ticking and tying and making sure there are no glaring errors, because guaranteed someone will find them. And when you're talking about that kind of money, they can get pretty anxious. So you have to make sure you're pretty thorough with your review. And that could take a lot of time on it. When it's not close and it's just like a basic day, a lot of time I spend in entering stuff in the accounting software, that the stuff that, you know, anything from, like I mentioned, rent being paid to a distribution going out to all the shareholders in a particular fund, making sure that, you know, communications are going out when they need to go out. There's a lot of legal documents in this world, so there could be a lot of time spent getting everyone to sign something and get it back and make sure they sign in the right place and it's all good to go. There's, I'm trying to think, at Kendall, it's a little different, because it's a little more, there are a lot of things going on in terms of in the portfolio, because Metaphase is a smaller place where, well, it's not smaller in terms of capital, but it's a different structure in that the guy who runs it is he looks for these biotech firms and invests and then just monitors them. So if something's about to happen, it's pretty obvious it's about to happen. You know, he's like the companies that they're in contact that it's about to go public or whatever. And whereas at Kendall, since he's invested in so many different funds, there's constantly cash coming in and going out, because there's, you know, if he's invested in however X amount of funds, those funds themselves have, you know, X amount of companies in them. And so things get bought and sold or whatever all the time, and there's cash coming in. You got to make sure that it's that we know what it is, that it's getting properly applied to our models that show how those funds are performing individually. Got to make sure the accountants are aware of them. You got to make sure they're going to the right place. And then eventually, when enough of money comes in, you have to make sure that you send that money out to shareholders. Or I shouldn't call them shareholders. They're called limited partners. These are partnerships. And those are the investors in the funds.
Sure.
And so then that requires some back and forth in terms of calculating how much you're going to send out. Some budgeting goes into it, because you need to keep some money at the fund to keep the lights on. And so it's kind of a lot of ins and outs of cash. And then the other side of it is making sure that we are keeping on top of all the investments and all the companies within those investments, because there might be something moving that catches our eye and we need to look into it further. If one of the companies within one of the funds we're invested in moves significantly in fair value, it might mean something happened, either good or bad, and you need to kind of follow up on that.
Sure. Okay, so hey, to qualify for these interviews, one of the criteria is that you enjoy what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to hear, what is it about your job, or at least your field, that you enjoy?
I enjoy a lot of things. So there's two parts. There's the parts that my jobs allow me to do, which is I have flexible hours and I can work remotely, and so that's, you know, the work life balance is pretty good.
About how many hours a week do you work, by the way?
It can depend. You know, right now is a busy time of year because it's the end of the year. Taxes are getting done. All these funds that are within these investment firms have to get audited by an independent auditor, mm-hmm. and that's always a fun experience, and that can take a lot of time. So it can get busy, and I don't know exactly how many hours. It could happen where I'll work a bit on the weekend, but then I might, only work half a day on Monday or something. So it can get up to like 50 hours if it's really, if it's busy. And
just curious, are you paid by the hour then? So if you work,
I am, yeah.
So
I am
if paid you work more, hour. You're paid more.
If I work more, I'm paid more. Yes, that is definitely a benefit. And then, there are times where it's slower and I take a little more time to play my guitar. And so it can, I would say it varies between, 30 to 50, depending on at what point we are in what cycle.
Sure. Okay. So you said the work-life balance is a nice thing and being able to work from home and the flexibility you were going on to then there was another thing you like.
Yeah. Well, so then there's the jobs itself, which, I forgot to mention too that I work my bosses are great. I work for two great guys, and with some other great people. They pay me fairly, unless they're listening to this, in which case they don't pay me enough. And then I would say, it's really makes a difference liking the people you work with, and I do work with some really, really great guys. And then for the job itself, it's an interesting industry because it's a startup and company specific industry. So you're kind of plugged into the world in a little bit in terms of how money gets made and how it kind of gets spread around to different people, and you learn a lot of very interesting things that could be very applicable to a lot of different industries. At Kendall, where I track a lot of the investment portfolio performances, I have to read a lot about how companies are doing, what they're doing to be competitive, and then I have to write about them let the LPs know that the limited partners that how they're doing, and that can be interesting because you learn a lot about a lot of different companies. And then there's the kind of financy intellectual exercise that goes along with it, which is which some people might not like, but I do like. I kind of have an analytical mind in that respect, kind of doing some of the number crunching and figuring out how things are doing. It's not the most exciting job some of the times, because there's a lot of times where you're just kind of, working with spreadsheets and making sure things are adding up the way they should. But it's more fun, I think, than being an accountant at a company where you're just plugging in payroll or something like that.
Sure.
Because it's an exciting industry. There's a lot of money comes in, companies get bought. It's a world that attracts passionate people, because it's of the excitement and the opportunity that is available.
Understood. Great answer. All right. So hey, I believe you said you graduated in 2010.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. So hey, let's take it back now to 2010.
2010.
Or earlier, if you want.
Okay.
Guessing you weren't thinking you were going to be a kind of accountant / admin at some venture capital firms?
No, I was not.
Okay. So, hey, put us in the headspace that you were in that spring, and then we'll sort of go one step at a time from, where you were there to what brought you to here.
Sure. So I'll bring it back maybe a couple of years before 2010,
sure.
because that was when I was kind of about halfway or more through Berkeley, and I realized that I probably wasn't going to make it as a professional musician, and nor did I really want to try, just because I didn't think I would be very suited for that lifestyle. And I kind of started to think, what else would I be good at or would want to do? And then at one point, I took Kevin Blockschwenk's math class,
hey,
which
hey.
When I realized, you know, that I should probably get some real world applicable knowledge under my belt. I thought, you know, I haven't taken a math class in a couple of years. It might be good to kind of get some of that going. And I did, and it was great. And I got interested kind of in finance a little bit. There was a guy, my parents' neighbor, actually, my parents lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time, was kind of starting this boutique investment hedge fund type thing. And he was talking to me about it, and he was a passionate guy, and we were friends, and he kind of said, you know, when you graduate, if you want to come learn the ropes and be kind of an intern, that would be great. And so I kind of latched onto that because I didn't really know what else to do. And I started just kind of reading about the industry and
okay,
how it works.
Done with Berkeley at this point, or
oh yes, yeah. So I had graduated Berkeley at this point. I kind of started towards the end of Berkeley, I started taking classes in business and
just as part of the pro music major. You mean. Like,
well,
music
it wasn't. I kind of had fulfilled everything I needed for the major, so I was kind of up to me to kind of take what I wanted after that point. And pro music
you're
is
taking music business courses at Berkeley, or do you mean other business classes?
No, at Berkeley, yeah, at Berkeley, I was taking the music business classes, and you know they had some basic finance and stuff available as electives, so I started taking those.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess actually probably was around that point that I took your class. And I at that point I was like, oh shoot, I should have done music business. I should have graduated with a business degree. But at that point it was like, man, I gotta get out of, I've been in college too long, I gotta graduate. I did flirt with the idea of transitioning at a later stage to music business. But it was just kind of like it wasn't worth it at that point. But I do wish I had done the music business major, but I would never have guessed that when I first started at Berkeley. So hindsight's always 20/20. So I graduated, I put out flyers, in around the neighborhood of, where my parents lived, guitar lessons for you know, individual guitar lessons. And those worked better than I thought they would. I should mention too, for most of Berkeley, and I was a guitar teacher at a small school in Littleton, Massachusetts called Oak Middle Montessori, kind of in their after school program, but it was only like once a week, but it provided a steady stream of some cash. And then I kind of, since I knew that there was money to be made doing that, I took on some more students by putting those flyers out. And then word of mouth happened, and I got a couple more. So I built up a pretty solid base of guitar students that kind of kept me afloat so that I could dabble with this finance stuff and not get paid for it. And so I just kind of hung around my friend slash boss who was starting a hedge fund and learned some finance stuff about investing and everything.
I think you said you started reading about it too.
I did, yeah. I did my homework a bit. And I was intrigued by it. You know, it's interesting. It's kind of always in your face if you pay attention to, you know, like the stock market and stuff. You know, it's kind of, you can get wrapped up in it pretty easily if you decide you're interested in it. And there's just a whole mess of information that you can get lost in. So it's, you know, I decided to kind of start sorting through it and seeing if there was anything there for me. And I kind of came to the conclusion after about a year of doing that. Oh, I should also say, before I graduated, before I knew I was going to do this, finance thing too, I cold called a nonprofit agency called New England Foundation for the Arts, which is in Boston, and they're kind of like this grant writing program to facilitate, you know, creative people and the arts all around New England. So they have a big dance thing where they, you know, dance companies send in their like audition videos, and they give grant money to them so they can continue with their work. They do a big public art thing. They're a very legit organization that also, when I was there, was at least partly funded by the National Endowment for the Arts, which is the federal thing. Uh-huh. And so I towards the end of Berkeley, when I was kind of deciding what I wanted to do, I thought about, well, it'd be cool to work in nonprofit world and some kind of arts agency because I like music and art, and I need a job. And so I just kind of sent them a cover letter and a resume out of, you know, without them having posted any kind of ad for an intern or anything. And I said, hey, I'm graduating Berkeley, and, you know, I would love to intern for you guys. How would you like some free labor? And they got back to me and said, like, yeah, why not? Come on by and we'll figure something out. So when I graduated, I had that internship set up as like a summer internship.
Cool.
And I started there, and then I guess it was probably a little before I started that when the guy who was starting the hedge fund, and I was talking to him about the stuff I was learning and everything, he's like, well, if you want to, you know, do part-time there and part-time here, we can get two internships going. So at one point I was teaching guitar lessons, interning at New England Foundation for the Arts, and interning at the my friend's investment fund.
That's a very full plate. It sounds like
these
were unpaid internships too, correct?
They were unpaid. They were certainly unpaid.
A lot more time than money.
Yes. Yeah. But they were very valuable in a lot of ways. And they gave me great insight into both worlds. And then when those things were kind of winding down, I decided that I wasn't.
Just that, like the fall, by the way, or fall of 2010?
Oh, man, I don't remember. That was so many years ago. I mean, actually, it wasn't that long ago, but I
was just curious if you're kind of like this internship with the financial, like, did it go for a year, just kind of like a few months?
Yeah. I always have, it's funny, I always have this, like, kind of, I'm thinking back whenever I have to, like, update my resume and they're asking for dates and everything, I'm like, oh, man. If anyone's listening to this, my advice to you is to write down the dates of every part of your professional life, because it will come up again. but I think I did the summer internship at NEFA, which is New England Foundation for the Arts. And then they asked me to stay on a little longer, and I did. And then the guy who I was interning with at his hedge fund was that kind of went out a little longer, because I kind of just kind of kept that on the side as I was teaching and deciding what I was going to do. Yeah. And so I don't know. I'm bad with timing, but it was.
It's all good. So
you get the general idea at least.
But what you were saying, though, as this was winding down, sorry, before I cut you off, you were starting to.
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of like, you know, what do I do now? Like the internship's over. I could commit to my friend's hedge fund a little harder, or I could go back to school. And what would I go back to school for? So I kind of took the route of, well, I'm not. I decided that, you know, stock market investing wasn't my thing. It just I just didn't really have the temperament for it, and I think it's kind of questionable how much you can really do on the stock market, but that's a whole nother discussion, as I'm sure you know as an economics teacher, about the whole efficient market.
Efficient market hypothesis.
Right? Yeah.
You
so I
have statistically beat the average, so just get
right.
something cheap.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so it's I should say the guy I was working with was beating the market. So I don't know if it was a fluke or he was a genius or what, but he did do very well at the time I was there. But I just knew I didn't really think it was a long term thing for me. So but I did like the finance business stuff, and I kind of thought, well, what about accounting? Accounting might be a good thing because it's still kind of got that business financy aspect to it. But I also, what appealed to me the most about it was how the broad range of industry you can go into after doing it. So, you know, if you get a degree in finance, it's going to be a good degree to have, but it's kind of, it pigeonholes you a little bit more as to, you know, what you can expect to do afterward in what industry. You know, you're going to be doing something kind of financy related probably. And with accounting, you know, everyone needs accountants, right? I mean,
right.
Just type in accounting jobs on Craigslist and you'll see ones for like organic farms and then ones for AIG. So it was like, I like that. I like how I kind of didn't have to decide what I had to do with it. So I studied for the GMATs. That took a while.
The SAT test for business school, sort of.
Exactly. Yeah. The GREs are for like if you're, you know, for certain types of grad schools where it's not as business esque. Like, you know, if you're going for education or something, you might do the GREs, and the GMATs are like the business equivalent of it. Mm-hmm. They're not easy or fun. So I had to take a while to study for that. And again, thank God I took Kevin Block Schwenk's math class, because otherwise I would have been pretty, I would have been in a bad shape for some of the basic math that I had to know just to take those tests. And I, all the while, I kind of taught guitar lessons while I went back and started studying for these. So that's how I kind of made my living. Not that it was a, you know, super lucrative living, but it was a living. And I took the tests. I applied to grad schools, and then I got in to, and I decided, okay, I'm going for it. And I went.
Where
and
did you go?
Boston College.
Cool.
Which is local. I'm sure. I'm guessing you've heard of it.
Oh yeah.
and I, so I only applied to local places. I didn't really feel like moving out of town. And I
not like we have a shortage of colleges in Boston.
Yep, that's very true. That's very true. And
what was the specific program that you were in?
So there a bunch of these. I applied to a bunch of schools that have what's called a master's in accounting. It's a master's of science in accounting. And there are some schools that have them specific programs for people who don't have accounting undergraduate degrees. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, and that's true for a lot of business degrees. There's probably finance and MBAs where it doesn't require to have a business undergrad degree. And there's usually a little more to it than if you did have a degree. There's more prereqs you had to take. And since I had something very far from a business degree, I had a bunch more prereqs that I had to take than most people, because it turns out most people in my program were from not accounting degrees, but economics, business administration, finance, that kind of stuff. So I had a little bit more catching up to do. And so I got in, I went, it was challenging for sure. And when I'll back up a little bit. When I went to
Was this like a 2-year master's program?
It was about a year and a half.
Year and a half, okay.
Depending on how many prereqs you had to do, but it was about a year and a half. Said and done.
Sorry, I cut you off there. You were saying like when you went into the program.
So I was when I went into the program, when I was first applying at these schools and I went to the admissions open houses, they said I was at like a round table with the accountants who were the accounting people who were applying for the master's degrees. And they said, okay, who here wants to work for the Big Four? And literally everyone at the table raised their hands. And I had no idea what this meant, but I did not want to be the only person not raising their hand. So I just raised my hand, not knowing what that meant. but then when I got to the program, it became increasingly clear what that meant, which was there are, four huge public accounting firms that kind of dominate the public accounting, world, which
there used
is
to be a Big Five before Arthur Anderson was caught signing off on Enron's crooked bucks.
That's right. That's right. Exactly right. And if I don't know if you've seen the documentary, The Smartest Men in the Room, but it might be a good one to show your economics class or something that kind of outlines that, how Enron happened and gives you a little bit of a insight into the public accounting world. But so I when I got there, it became increasingly clear that most people's, almost everybody's desire was to get a job at one of these public accounting firms. And what these public accounting firms do is they audit other companies. So when most people hear the word audit, they think the IRS. But most all public companies that are traded on a stock exchange are audited.
That means you confirm
every year
that their numbers are legit.
They hire outside firms to review, in theory, their financial statements to say that they are presenting them fairly and in accordance with, accounting standards issued by government agencies. Mm-hmm. And this is a huge industry. I didn't know. I think the accounting industry is, I think, the biggest industry in the country. I heard that it might be unsubstantiated, but I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be surprised. These are gigantic companies with offices in every city everywhere. And those big four firms, along with some smaller firms, all come and recruit right off the campus of a lot of these schools, or they have their kind of select schools that are basically these feeder schools into their companies because they just constantly need bodies. And so I kind of got swept up in this whirlwind of wanting to get a job at these big companies. And between the learning what accounting was at a very rapid pace and interviewing at these big companies, it was a pretty stressful experience, but I got through it. And I did end up getting a job at one of the big firms called Deloitte. The full name, I think, is Deloitte and Touche, and I can't remember what the third name
is.
That's
one of the Big Four.
That is one of the Big Four. And the Big Four, I should say, are PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, KPMG, and Ernst & Young. So I when I graduated, I took a little time off to study for the CPA, which people have probably heard of the designation, but it's like it stands for Certified Public Accountant, and
So it sounds like this accounting thing, it's a little bit like law school where you get your law degree, but then you have to pass the bar exam in order to actually practice. Is it kind of like that?
I don't know. Well, I think I'm not sure how the law world works in terms of what you're allowed to do when you're not licensed, but you can make a career as an accountant not being a CPA. A lot of people do that. Huh. But for the public accounting world where you are auditing other companies as kind of like a public agent, you are, or you don't, by the way, they audit private companies too. Some private companies get audited, all public companies get audited, and there's investment firms that get audited and blah, blah, blah. But there, to get to a certain level, you have to be a CPA. I don't know what level it is, but eventually if you're high enough up in the ranks doing certain things, then it's required that you are a CPA. Like you have to be a CPA to write an opinion where you, the auditor's opinion is what it's called, when at the end of the audit, you kind of sign this official document that says we think we've done our job and this looks good to us, essentially.
So basically by getting the CPA on top of your accounting degree, it opens up more opportunities.
Yes, it does. I mean, it's definitely a shining star in your resume. And it's kind of, it's just this professional designation that kind of says that you're at a certain level.
Sharing, if you're not comfortable, it's okay, but do you mind sharing like what your starting pay was when you got this job?
Sure. I'll say it and then I'll tell you the huge caveat afterwards.
Okay.
So the starting pay fresh out of school it was about $57,000.
That's okay. I mean, it's not like, oh my God, but it's okay.
Well, it's they recruit people who are fresh out of school who have never had a job before, and that is a very good starting salary for someone who has never really worked anywhere before.
True.
And there's bonuses too. And if you pass your CPA within the first year, there's an X amount of bonus, and I can't remember, what it is if you don't, but depending on your job performance, blah, blah, blah. They get you in with saying like, hey, you're about to, graduate. Would you like a big boy salary at a fancy firm? In which case you're like, the biggest driver behind going to these places is the prestige, because you're going to a big firm that everyone knows, that where your job is to learn how a lot of different companies do their accounting. So it's not like you're getting a job at one company learning one type of thing. Like your every day is going to be different. You're going to always be learning. So it is really, really good experience if you're looking to be in the accounting world.
Great. What was the caveat?
The caveat is you don't stop working. And so if you did my hourly pay, you might as well work at Costco or something. There's something what's called busy season where a majority of the work happens right after the year, where companies are putting their audited financial statements out and submitting to the SEC. And you could be, you don't stop working. You can work late into the night, go home, get a few hours of sleep, and get up and go back to work. And that is a, 7 day a week thing for a few months.
Ouch.
It can be brutal. It can be brutal. There is a payoff, which is if you stay long enough and get to a certain level, you're very competitive for some good paying jobs. But it's definitely will take up a lot of your life to work there. I made it through one busy. I should say I interned at Deloitte twice before I took the full-time job, because it kind of just worked with my school schedule. I went for a few months, interned, and then after I graduated, I went back full-time. And I stayed through one busy season as a full-timer. And as fate would have it, so my brother works in venture capital. He runs a venture capital firm in Colombia, the country of all places that invests in U.S. startups. And one of the startups he was thinking about investing in was this woman who was starting a music startup and for kind of a way of hiring musicians through kind of, I hesitate to say like Uber because it wasn't, but like, making it easier to find musicians for whatever event kind of on a on-demand basis.
Sure.
And I was, you know, not, I knew the public accounting world was not for me in the long term. And the question is how long I want to stay and kind of fluff up my resume and get the experience so that I could go into whatever afterwards, or do I take a jump and try something out while I'm still young and unattached, and see if, you know, with big risk comes big reward type thing. Uh-huh. And I liked the business, and I kept thinking about it. Originally, my brother just put me in touch with her because he knew I went to Berkeley, and he said he can introduce some musicians and whatnot, and I did, and I kind of kept contact with her, and eventually I was kind of like, you know what, like, why don't I just come on board and try this out? And so I left very prematurely for someone who works at these firms. I left after about 7 or 8 months, not including the two internships.
In order to work at the music startup.
Yep.
What was your position at the music startup?
Vice president.
Right.
That's the other thing about working at a startup at an early stage is you get lofty titles. And so I left. Everyone was really cool about it. They all wished me luck. No one gave me any grief about leaving early. And I appreciated that. And they also said, if it doesn't work out, you can come back.
Well, that's nice.
And I said, thanks. In the back of my mind, I said, there's no way I'm coming back. But, so we said our goodbyes, and I joined the startup. That did not work out for various reasons. And that became evident in a very short period of time.
Would you say it didn't work out? Do you just mean you weren't happy there? Do you mean that the startup was circling the drain financially?
Well, I mean, when I say startup, I mean, like, it was me and her, you know, like, I mean, we worked in two different cities. We had not even gone to market yet, looking for investments. So it was like really seed level. And, so it was way too early to see if it was circling the drain. I wasn't happy. It just became clear that it wasn't going to work out. And it's good that I left, actually, because, she ended up, abandoning it and went to work at Snapchat. She was this Harvard MBA that kind of had this whirlwind of ideas, and so it was kind of hard to keep up with her in some respects. But I was grateful for the opportunity she gave me.
So this was like a few months there or something.
Right? Yeah, just a few months.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was kind of like, okay, well, now it's time to get a job. Like, I took a leap and it didn't work, so now I got to find something that does. And I just kind of started looking for places. And then, oddly enough, the same guy who I had worked for at his hedge fund, who had now taken a different job at a money manager, said, hey, my friend who works at the office next to me, who runs a venture capital firm, needs his office manager / accountant just quit and needs some help. And it's a part-time job. And it might be a good way for you to kind of get in the industry. And I was like, yeah, dude, sure. Send it over. Let's give it a shot. And then I got in touch with him, and he was like, yeah, we'd love to have you. And, also there's a investor of ours who also needs somebody kind of in that sphere. And, can I put you in touch with him? And I said, please do. And then that kind of got the ball rolling of saying, like, maybe there's this, segment.
Your current jobs, by the
and
way?
They are my current jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, but please continue. Sorry. You said got the ball. You were thinking, hey.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of, when I got the first job and then, while the other one was kind of coming to fruition, it took a little while longer. I thought this is kind of interesting that there's this world that needs this kind of service, at various levels doing various things. And I was like, you know, I could get on board with the idea of at working multiple places and kind of, you know, being exposed to different things and maybe having a little more control of my schedule. And having just come from a company where every hour is dedicated to them, it was nice kind of thinking of a work lifestyle where I kind of had a little more control. And so I pestered the other person, the other guy at Kendall where I work now, until he finally gave in and gave me a job. And it kind of started off with like, well, I have this project. I need some valuations done for my audit. Like, do you want to maybe try that out? And I was like, sure. And truth be told, I didn't really know what I was doing. But I kind of figured it out along the way. And as I kept kind of showing up and doing, and he kept kind of just giving me work until it turned into something. And now it's turned into something pretty robust. And I think there's a future there, and there's a lot of room to grow because it's a growing company, and he's a great guy who is willing to give me more and more. But so that's kind of how it just kind of happened by chance. It wasn't even really a concerted effort on my part to get into that industry. It just kind of fell in my lap. And I ran with it.
So you had done a good internship for this guy at one point. Had you done a bad job? He probably.
Well, he was, yeah. I'm sorry, say that last part again.
I said, had you done a poor job when you interned?
Right,
he likely
right.
He would not have recommended you.
Right, right, yeah, exactly. I mean, he's also a close friend of mine. But yeah, no, I don't think he would have recommended me if I'd done a bad job. And I kind of just stuck with it, and it worked. It felt great. I really like it. I like the flexibility, but I also like how I have to be, you know, it would become obvious very fast if I wasn't doing my job, because things just wouldn't be done, and investors would be pretty angry. So to that extent, I kind of get this autonomy because they're like, you know what your job is, now go do it, you know, and it's not like I'm micromanaged, and I get to kind of be flexible on where I can be and how I can do it. And it works really well for me. And it's like I said in the beginning, it's two interesting industries, investing in interesting companies. And most importantly to me, not that you asked this, but I like the idea of working at places that I agree with their mission statement. So like when I said I went to work for the nonprofit, and then wound up in the business world, I don't think I could work for a company or an investment firm where I felt like they weren't around for a reason. And they were just kind of doing something that I disagreed with. I think both these places are very, very much so two places that I believe in their investment philosophy, and that they are actually adding value to the world by being there. And so it's a lot easier to work for a place that you feel like, you know, is doing good, whether it's not, you know, necessarily charitable good, but it's
creating good, valuable products that people are going to
get.
Good,
yeah, you know, they're not swindling anyone, you know. If I had a lot of money, I would invest in them, but I don't.
Not yet. All right, very cool. So hey, let's move on to the third part of the interview.
Sure.
Of three. So my first question for you is, at the moment, what, if anything, is your relationship with music?
I still play all the time. You know, with these jobs, since I get to kind of be a little more control of my schedule, I make sure to find time to practice every day or most days. Mm-hmm. I love music. I mean, I think most musicians would agree that it's one of those things where it's not something you do, it's something you are, it kind of deep down. So it's never, I don't think it's ever going to leave. I practice, like I said, about it pretty much every day. Eventually, as I get back into it a little more, because I had a bit of a falling out, you know, during the when I was in grad school and everything just got so intense time wise, and then going to work for the company and studying for the CPA and blah blah blah. I mean, it got pushed to the side a bit. So I'm trying to reacquaint myself and get back to the level that I once was, and I would like to have some kind of semi-professional side career with music at some point. It's still a goal of mine. I don't think I'll ever make a ton of money doing it, and I'm not sure I'd even care about making any money doing it, but I definitely want it to be a big part of my life.
Very cool. All right, so next question for you, and you've alluded to this a little bit earlier, but we can sort of continue on the theme, is, you know, you went to Berklee knowing it gave that one degree, a Bachelor of Music,
mm-hmm.
What you got. But, you know, thinking about where you ended up and what you're doing now, you know, is there anything where you, when you look back at your Berklee education, you feel that Berklee did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now relative to if you'd gone to another college? Like, you know, you said nice words about my math class, but there would have been a math class at another college, right? But, you know, is there a specific thing where you're like, hey, you know, the fact that I went to Berklee, you know, helped me out, made me better at what I'm doing now because this?
Well, for one thing, I mean, so you're saying specific to my career?
I'm saying, thinking... I'm not asking you to, you know, you're not putting on the hat of some, you know, minister of education evaluating mm-hmm. Berklee, right?
Mm-hmm.
You are Will Stedler, you know, accountant at venture capital firms.
Right.
And you're thinking, like, you know, you're not the only accountant of venture capital firms who's out there. And I'm guessing the overwhelming majority of them did not go to Berklee.
Right.
They have very different educational backgrounds.
Yeah.
And is there anything where you're like, hey, the fact that I'm a Berklee grad, that's given me a leg up or a benefit, or it's really, you know, given me something that most other people in my position don't have? And if so, like, what did Berklee do for you?
Well, so for one thing, I learned a lot about music at Berklee. I want to make that, like, I know that's not, you know, necessarily applicable to making me competitive in my field, but, you know, there also is a very analytical aspect to music that there isn't to other degrees, like, I don't know, being like an English major, right? So it kind of at least was exercising the right parts of my brain. And I think it's a terrific school for if you want to learn music. Specific to my scenario, I will tell you the thing that was most valuable is the fact that I went there at all, because it stood out and made me unique in a crowd of people who had very similar backgrounds. So at one point, even during when I was interviewing for the Big Four, I was talking to a recruiter who came to campus, and I was like, yes, so I kind of have an unconventional background. She's like, oh, wait, are you the music guy? And I was like, well, yeah, how'd you know that? She's like, oh, I was talking to so-and-so at the department, and they were talking about their class, and they said they even had someone who graduated Berklee or something like that. And so I'm sure it helped me get into grad school. Because they, you know, schools like to have diversity, and not just in, you know, race, creed, and religion, but also in educational background. Mm-hmm. And so it helped me, I think it stand out when I was applying to grad schools, and it helped me stand out when I was applying to other schools, jobs. So it's been a very valuable conversation starter. And in terms of what that like actual education did for me, I would say it was towards the end when since there is a music business program, I got to kind of start switching into taking classes that were more relevant to my field now and getting a good foundation. Do I think they were better than I would have gotten at other schools? I don't know, probably not. But that coupled with the fact that I had a kind of unconventional background really actually proved to be an asset and continues to be.
Gotcha. Great answer. Hey, let's turn the question around now.
Alrighty.
Because, of course, Berklee does give that one degree, a Bachelor of Music, and you went there knowing that. And you certainly have a good career now. But is there anything where you look back at Berklee and you say, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this when I was at Berklee, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything you feel Berklee, should have been teaching you or at least covered inadequately that you would have been different?
In the same vein, I would say, if Berklee, I always equate it to a gym. When people ask me about it or ask if they should go there. And I say in my experience, and this was 7 years ago, so it may have changed a lot, but it was like a gym in the sense that you can sign up and then it's kind of up to you to get in shape, right? So all the equipment is there, all the resources there are there for you to make yourself into the best musician or businessman or woman possible. But it's kind of up to you to make sure that you show up and do it and get the best out of it. In that sense, I when I was lucky, I kind of started towards the end realizing that I wasn't going to be in the music career. And so I started shifting my focus to more applicable classes. So I would say that if, Berklee wasn't the kind of place to kind of lead your hand in that direction, and if they, music's a tough field to go into after you graduate, it's not known for being such a lucrative career and as a professional musician. So if I think any kind of more focus on career accessible paths might be a good idea. Like I took
you mean
a
helping people figure out what they want.
A more robust career department. I know they have one, and I shouldn't criticize it because I never even took advantage of it. So it may be very robust, but they certainly didn't come pick me out of the crowd and say like, hey, you look like a wayfaring person, you might want to take a look and see if we can find something that works for you. And in that same vein, they don't kind of say, here's classes that you should probably take or skills that you should probably learn to kind of be ready for a job at this point. And so I think, it's tough because it's such a competitive field that you don't want them to be less competitive in music and be not good musicians, but at the same time, since it's such a competitive field, it might be good to have some more applicable job skills like computer training and that kind of thing.
Gotcha. Okay.
Did that answer the question?
Yeah, no. great. There's no right or wrong answer, but no, definitely is sort of made a couple great points there. So
good.
The next question I have for you is, I mean, in a way, it's pretty admirable that even you start to get a sense of what you wanted to do that was outside music. But, when you were still at Berklee, you were already like, okay, here's the direction I think I want to go. And you pretty quickly narrowed it down.
Mm-hmm.
It was an instant, right? But you were kind of like, okay, a kind of business thing, okay, a kind of financial thing, all right, accounting, and then pretty quickly what you're doing now. It's great. As I'm sure you can imagine, not everybody has found their path.
Right.
You know, especially a lot of recent grads. And there's also perhaps people who might be in a position you were in at some point at Berklee where they might start to be sensing that maybe a music career isn't for them, but oh my God, what do I do now?
Mm.
Right? And for either or both of those groups, do you have any advice?
Oh man, I should have anticipated this question. I'll say that I think there's no blanketed advice that can be applied to everybody's situation. So, I want to preface it with that. I think the biggest attribute, the most valuable attribute that every single Berklee student has is they're passionate, right? And not only are they passionate, but they are dumb enough to follow their dreams. And I don't mean that as a pejorative. I mean that as a compliment. Because playing it safe is smart, and taking the easy route is smart, but it's not necessarily fulfilling. So I can't point them in a direction of like a specific career path because, to each his own. But right. In terms of the kind of mindset you should have, I think it's kind of like, and I immediately hate this analogy I'm about to make. And so if you quote me on it, make sure you like preface it with the fact that Will is doing this with much reticence. But I'm going to do it anyway. It's kind of like investing, where you have a portfolio that is geared towards risk or not risk, right? When you're a certain age, if you're nearing retirement, you don't want all your money to be in startups because who knows what's going to happen to them. Right. And at the same time, when you're 20, just starting your retirement fund, you don't want to invest in bonds because you're not going to make a whole lot of return off of them. So the same can be kind of applied to what you do in the early parts of your life in terms of career. And you have to kind of analyze the situation you're in, right? If you're about to graduate college and you realize that you don't want to be a musician and you have a music degree and $100,000 in debt, it's probably a good idea to start thinking pretty seriously about a career change that could make you some money to that could be lucrative and help you pay down that debt. At the same time, if you just graduated college and you said, well, my parents paid for my degree, would rather live in a cardboard box than not be a musician, then I think you're kind of you're less risk averse, and you should follow that. And I think also there needs to be a kind of a confluence of what your dreams are and what a pragmatic reality is. So that's how I kind of wound up in my situation. I couldn't live not working towards being a better musician. That's not really an option. But at the same time, I know that I don't really want to make that my full-time thing. So I kind of made something. I chose something that's pragmatic, and something that kind of affords me a little bit of dream time. And even it looks like I'm a CPA. I got a master's degree in accounting. That's considered a very pragmatic route, but I'm also, a contractor with no benefits at two different places with no employment contract too that could end at any time. So if I was a, 4-year-old married person with a mortgage and two kids, I'd be a little nervous about my situation, but I'm not. And so, anyways, this is a long way of me saying, you know, take a step back and analyze your situation. What kind of risk can you afford to take at this point in life, and have a fallback plan? And maybe that means augmenting your career with something a little more pragmatic, or maybe it means going for broke and trying to pick up the pieces if it doesn't work. And you know, I think people will realize when they if they do try to switch careers that having a creative degree from a reputable school is not a hindrance. It is definitely an asset if you use it correctly. So keep your mind open and find what works for you, and eventually it'll work itself out.
Okay. Hey, that's great. And to just focus the question in a little bit more, because, you know, you're somewhere in the, your interview number is somewhere in the upper 60s in terms of how many folks have been interviewed.
Okay.
I actually peaked at otherberkeleygrads.com.
I did a few, yeah.
Yeah, a good number of interviews up there.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can imagine not everyone's going to go down the line listening to every single one. In fact, probably
right.
No one will. So, like, the people who click on yours, you know, I think I'll have you in there under finance as to, you know, like venture capital accountant.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
I would probably not use the word accountant so okay. much. I mean, I do aspect accounting. I'm more like a finance and operations manager is probably more applicable
finance
to what I do.
Operations. All right, that's cool. That's cool. So
I just don't want to give people a false idea of what being an accountant is, because it's being like a fund accountant is a little different than what I do.
Finance operations manager. All right, under there. Point being, the people who are listening to this are
yep.
going to be the ones who clicked on that.
Right.
Right. So the ones who are like, a finance and operations manager, hey, that sounds pretty cool. What's that
mm-hmm.
all about? So if somebody's kind of pondering that as a career, do you have any specific advice for them?
Yeah. I would say, if they're business majors, then they already have a good start. There are all kinds of opportunities to start in a kind of entry level position at whatever firm. And you know, you might have to start at the bottom and doing some stuff that you feel underqualified for, but it's the kind of field where there is no ceiling, you know? So you'll, if you're talented and work hard, you'll be recognized for it pretty quick. If you don't have a business degree, I would suggest maybe thinking about going back and doing something like what I did, if you have the resources or the time to get a finance or an accounting degree or an MBA even. That certainly will open a whole lot more doors, because probably places will recruit right from the school that you're studying at. And then if you want to take it to the next level and be a little more competitive, it'd be something like doing a CPA or a CFA or something, which is a chartered financial analyst, which kind of make you stand out a little more. And then you kind of have to figure out from there what your goals are. If you're looking to get really successful at big companies, it might be a good idea to work at a public accounting firm for a while and get that experience under your belt. But you have to network and kind of, you got to, it's an esoteric path. So you have to learn the nuances that make you seem like you know what you're talking about.
Great. Hey, just got one last question for you.
Sure.
Which is, you have the mic, and you're being recorded. So, is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything we missed?
I guess no. I feel like I've talked a lot, but I again will give a shout out to Kevin Blockschwank's math class. Do you still teach? Is that class still available?
It is available, and in fact, in 2012 into 2013, I did an online version for Berkeley Online as well.
No way.
Yeah, so that's actually like I have about 200 people a year take the online one, which is far more than I individually teach at Berkeley.
That's great, though. They're spreading your message. I can't recommend it enough. I often refer to it as one of the best classes I've ever taken. It really gave me a good foundation for the career that I eventually started working towards. So thank you for that.
We even did a couple present value calculations.
We certainly did.
So excellent. Well, hey, well, and not just because you buttered me up here. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Great. It was nice hearing from you.
You have to. Great. So, hey, look for a message from me in the very near future.
I will. And I will.
Thanks a lot. All the best to you, and best of luck with everything. Have a great evening.
You too. Take care.